This is my special power. Okay, everyone need to know what is his special power. So from the get-go, I knew that I'm not my special power is not to be a CEO and be the business person. I'm helping them a lot, but that's not my special power. But I know today, after 12 years doing that, that my special power is more innovation and building products and doing science and be excited about the science. So I'm doing that. Let the other do their job. And especially when the company is growing, definitely not be involved in everything. You can't, and it doesn't make sense.
Hi, everyone. We're very excited to have this conversation today with Dr. Gil Blunder. Hi, Gil.
Hello.
And Ofer here as well. Hi, Ofer.
Hello.
We met Gil through Science Abroad. It's a nonprofit organization we both volunteer for. And Gil actually founded Science Abroad when he was doing his postdoc at MIT. I think it's an interesting discussion because Science Abroad for a really long time supported mainly pursuit of academic careers, whereas Dr. Gil Blunder himself is actually a founder of a very exciting company, Insight Tracker, where he's also the current chief scientific officer. So we'll discuss Gil's career and current endeavors. And hi, Gil. Really, really excited to have you here. Thank you for joining us. So Gil, tell us a little bit about what you do now at Insight Tracker.
So Insight Tracker is a personalized nutrition company. We are helping people to optimize their performance using biomarkers such as blood biomarkers, DNA, and data from a fitness tracker, physiological data, such as resting heart rate, sleep, and other. We are combining all the information together. And then based on that, we are learning what are the issues that this person have. And based on that, we are building a plan for each person of what food to eat, what supplement to take, what exercise to do, and what lifestyle changes to do in order to optimize his performance and hopefully allow him to live longer, better life.
Amazing. So if I understood correctly, you're basically using sort of data that every doctor can have about our nutrition, our biology, right?
It could be, yeah. We have a panel of around 45 blood biomarkers that we can test everyone at a Quest Diagnostic, which is, some of it is a bit unique. So for example, if you go to your primary care physician, he usually won't test your testosterone or vitamin B12 or creatine kinase or even ferritin. But a high level, I would say like 70% of the blood biomarker that we are testing can be found or are using by a primary care physician. So, and if you have this data, you can definitely upload it into our platform.
Exciting. So how close it is to what you were doing during your PhD or postdoc?
So my PhD was done at the Weizmann Institute of Science, and I worked at the lab of Moshe Oren, which I assume a lot of you know is one of the pioneering in cancer research. And actually, when I joined this lab, I said that I'm very interested in aging, but not in cancer. But because he is the leader in at that time, he was the leader in maybe the leader scientist in biology in Israel, I said I want to work in the best lab. And at that time, I couldn't find any lab that studied aging. So Moshe told me, okay, go to the library and try to find something that is interesting for you, but it also fit my excitement about cancer. So I went to the library, and at that time, we haven't had the internet. It was long ago. It was, I think it was 1995 or something like that. So there used to be a disk of PubMed that every year had a disk. So I went from a disk to a disk to a disk.
Oh, wow.
and then I found something interesting about a premature aging syndrome that called Werner syndrome. I assume that most of you haven't heard about it, but it's a premature aging syndrome similar to progeria, but instead of dying at the second century of life, you die at the fourth century of life. And you die from premature aging syndrome. So the hair get gray and the cancer of aging and other symptom of aging. And what was interesting that at that time they sequenced, they identified the gene that responsible for this syndrome, and they found that it's an interesting enzyme, helicase and exonuclease together. I'm sure that all of you are scientists, so you know that most of the protein in our body have only one enzymatic activity, or even none, but this one had two. But because it was an helicase, the P53 have been shown in the past to interact with some other helicase. So I came to Moshe and said, okay, this is an helicase, P53 interact with helicase related to aging, let's work on that. So, so that's what I done at Moshe's lab. And then after that, I decided to do a postdoc at the lab of Lenny Garant at MIT, which is one of the leader scientists that studying aging. He is the scientist that identifies SIR2. From whoever doesn't know what is SIR2, SIR2 is a longevity gene that they found in yeast that extend lifespan. And later on, they showed that it's extending lifespan also in worms, and some other labs show that it's the homologue of SIR2 in mice can extend lifespan in a specific condition, and some of them also show it in Israel. So Chaim Cohen, I assume that some of you know, is a professor at Bar Ilan, and he showed that he's working at SIR6, and he showed that SIR6 can extend lifespan. So that's what I've done at Lenny's lab for 5 years. But when I arrived to MIT, I started to be exposed to the biotech pharmaceutical environment of Kendall Square. And whoever doesn't know what is Kendall Square is an area in a mile radius around MIT that they have a lot of companies, a lot of biotech, high-tech, pharmaceutical companies that most of them span out from MIT. And at that time, Lenny had a company, a former postdoc in that in our lab, now is very famous, David Sinclair, also started the company. And I was also looking for a specific compound to do some experiment, peptide library, to find the substrate of SIR1. And I looked at the Merck catalog and I found the substrates and I ordered it. And they said, sorry, the company that created this compound decided not to sell it anymore. So I said, okay, what is the, who is the, this company? And they told me it's a small startup that spun out from Boston University. So I asked them, can you give me the contact information? They gave it to me. I contacted this company and we started to work together in order to do this experiment. So I was exposed to that company. And on top of that, after a couple of years at the lab, Lenny came to me one day and said, Gil, Estée Lauder, the cosmetic company, is really interested in the research that you are doing. Are you looking for some more funding? So I said, of course, I'm looking for more funding. As a scientist, you know, you're all the time looking for more funding. So I was fortunate enough to get some funding from them for my postdoc. And I was exposed to the research that they have done. So all of that opened my eyes in a way and made me realize that, and again, I don't want to offend anyone, but my feeling at that time was that I might contribute more to humanity if I will start my own company that will help people to live longer, better life than being a professor in the academia that might publish one or two papers a year that maybe five other scientists will read.
Yeah, but in that point, you are already on track towards what I guess you started in a postdoc, the track towards academic position. And you started sidetracking, right? Or at least like looking to the sides, right? So what was like the course to a tenure track position in academia is like very linear. There's one course to go through. And in non-academic positions, as we have explored in this podcast, there are many options. And when you looked at those companies and Estée Lauder company, you had many, many options to look at: science, business, regulatory. What appealed to you most at that point?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And you are right, Ofer. I came to MIT with a clear understanding that I will do a postdoc for, I don't know, 2 to 5 years, and then move back to the Weizmann and be a professor there. That was my plan. But then when I started to be exposed to the industry, I realized that there is life outside of the academia. In my opinion, at that time, and now I can confirm it, it's much more exciting. You have much more opportunities. And as I said before, I think that you can contribute to humanity even more than what you are doing in the lab, because in the lab, it's a very, usually it's very basic science, and people think that it's easy, but it's very hard. I have a lot of friends that are professors, and it's very hard to get funding, and it's very hard to get a good postdoc or good student, and it's very hard. You fight with everyone. I think that what is also nice in the academia, that you are not a lonely wolf. In the academia, most of the time you're a lonely wolf. In the industry, you work in a team, so you have a team that's working with you. Now I have a very big team. Before that, I have a very small team, but still you're working with a team. All of that directed me to that. And again, my lifetime goal from the get-go was to try to allow people to live longer, better life. So that's why I came to the academia. That's why I joined the Weizmann Institute. That's why I joined MIT. And I was lucky enough to be exposed to a lot of different example of industry to realize that there is a lot of potential there.
I think you summarized most of the points we went through in the last almost 2 years of the podcast. We want to be closer to impact. We want to be, we want maybe work in a team and not be, as you mentioned, a lone wolf and not straying for those like funding opportunities that are very scarce and problematic. All those elements are very appealing to a lot of the audience in the industry or non-academical positions.
So your research sounds very interesting and obviously very applicative to maybe cancer biology or sort of aging, but it's very far from what you're doing at Insight Tracker, no?
It is and it's not, because So I can continue the story and how I got to start Insight Tracker. Yeah. So I decided to leave to the industry, and I started to interview in different companies. So I was fortunate enough to interview in companies like Merck and Biogen and a few other. And I also interviewed in a very small a startup that done a system biology, computational biology. And I went there and I met a couple of people that were the smartest people that I met. And it was a small startup, and I came from MIT, okay? So MIT always saying, oh, everyone is the next Nobel laureate. And actually in this small startup, I met a couple of very smart people. And I thought that computational biology and system biology is the future. So I said, okay, let's join that company. Just a side note, as an undergrad at Tel Aviv University, after a couple of years of undergrad, I started to be bored of working in the lab there. So I was looking for a job in the student center, and there was a job opening for a computer scientist that knows some biology. But I was aggressive enough to come to them and say, hey, I'm a biologist that know a bit about computer science. And the company name is CompuGen, whoever know it. It's a company that's still around a very long time. I joined them when only the founders and a couple of other employees worked there. And I joined them, and together we developed the first algorithm to identify splicing and know where take the genome and basically know how it's spliced together. And basically at that time, I went to the library and read papers about splicing. It was the time that a year or two after the splicing was identified. So as a biologist, I found the splicing recognition sequence. I worked with a computer scientist that basically assembled an algorithm based on that. And we developed the first splicing recognition algorithm. I worked there for a year and a half. And then when I joined the Weizmann, I felt like I don't have time. So I decided to resign. But I already had some experience with, let's say, computational biology. And I realized that it's very interesting. Again, at that time, I didn't want to do it. But when I went to that small company, when I finished the postdoc, I saw that it's a very good idea to learn a bit more about it. And using that to start, to try to find an idea, how can I build a company that can help people to live longer, better lives? So they develop basically a technology that you can push into their platform a lot of data, let's say RNA-seq or DNA-seq or a microarray or a proteomics. And then the platform basically build the pathway from that. So you look, for example, on all the microarray data, and you can combine all the target for P53, okay? Mm-hmm. Or all the target of, I don't know, E2F1, whatever. Mm-hmm. And because of that, you can know what pathway is activated. Because you know that those, I know, for P53, let's say that MDM2 and P21 and Bax are going up, so most likely P53 is activated. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting technology for me, and I said, okay, I'll join them. The company done mainly consulting for big companies, Pfizer and GSK and other, but I used that technology to do some fun stuff for me in the after hours. So for example, when I left MIT, I submitted a paper on my work with Estee Lauder on a keratinocyte differentiation using CRT1 overexpression in the RNAi. And as you know, all of you are scientists, you submit a paper and most likely it will get rejected. So it got rejected. So I said, okay, let's use this technology to build something more cool for the paper. So we done that and we published the paper. And then I felt that I have some free time and I didn't know what to do. And because of my fascination for aging, I said, okay, let's take all the publicly available data about caloric restriction. And I assume that everyone here knows what is caloric restriction and see what happening under the hood, why caloric restriction extend the lifespan in so many model organisms.
Right.
So I took a very big data set, again, all publicly available, push it via this platform and build basically a map of what's happening with caloric restriction. Mm-hmm. In a parallel to that, I also used data from a David Sinclair lab about resveratrol and try to see how resveratrol overlap with caloric restriction and how aging overlap with caloric restriction, basically comparing young and old mice.
Right.
And what I found is that there were around 18 different processes that are modulated by caloric restriction. Mm-hmm. Only 20% of them were overlapped by resveratrol, which was that, at that time was the best caloric restriction mimetic that we knew. Mm-hmm. And the aging also overlapped by 20%, but each of them was different. So basically, my conclusion from this experiment was the following. First, resveratrol only covered 20% of caloric restriction. Okay. Mm-hmm. Second, resveratrol is the best caloric restriction mimetic. So if I want to mimic caloric restriction completely by a small molecule, I will need a lot of them, maybe 20, because the best they cover 20%, maybe the second best will cover 10% and so on. And then my next conclusion was, it will be very hard to find those small molecules. And the next one was, why can't we use food as a drug of choice instead of using drug? Let's try to use food and try by that to optimize people. So I done it together with two other co-founder of mine that also work at that company. I started to look at, how can we know what are the issue of each person? So we decided very early to look at blood because blood validated, calibrated everything. It's like a liquid gold. It's showing you what's happening. There is a lot of data in the peer-reviewed mm-hmm. scientific publication. If you look at blood, there are at least one century back data about it. If you look at glucose, there are millions of peer-reviewed publication about glucose. So it's a data rich, a lot of information. And today, or before InsulTracker, we used it only for sick people. And we said, let's have people to stay healthy. Let's if you look at the prism of healthy to sick, it's not like one day you are healthy and the next day you are sick. There is basically some process. It's like a black and white. You have a lot of gray between. Right. So we said, let's try to understand the gray and try to push everyone as much as possible to the white and as much as possible further from the sick. Okay. Right. And so we zoom in into the blood biomarkers, but when we look at that, and we've seen that there are thousands and thousands of blood biomarker at Quest Diagnostic, which is the biggest lab in the US. So we said, okay, we cannot test 4,000 biomarkers because it will be super expensive. And also we might not have enough blood in our vein to do one of those tests. Right. So we started, I spent 2 years looking biomarker by biomarker and trying to fit whether it's good for us or not. I came with a few criteria, what is a good biomarker for us. And I came to a list of around 40 of those. But then when I started to implement it, I realized that to implement for 40, it will take a lot of time. So basically I made a tough decision and started with a panel of 10 just to start the company. And with time we added more and more, and every year we're adding more and more biomarkers because now we can, but then it's time consuming. It's a lot of work. We have a very big team of scientists and it's not easy to do that. So we are all the time have priority. What is the next most important blood biomarker to add?
So did the company you were in changed, or you started a new company out of it?
Yeah. So if we would like to go deep, so when we came with this understanding, when we done the experiment with caloric restriction, my co-founder told me, Gil, you have to quit your job because we cannot do it here. Those guys don't understand it well. And quit your job and we'll start the company. And I was naive enough to do that. So I quit my job.
You believed in your science enough. So.
Yeah, maybe. Either smart or stupid. So I quit my job. Luckily, the company that I discussed to you before that done the peptide library, the chief scientific officer at that company joined another company and asked me, Gil, do you want to join me? And he done next generation sequencing company. He built basically technology for next generation. So I said, yeah, I will join you. And in the meantime, at the evenings, I started to develop the technology for insert tracker. And then a year after I quit my work at that company, and the CEO of that company asked me, Gil, why do you leave us? We have a lot of potential and all of that. And I told him, I want to start my own company. And instead of kicking me out of the room, he told me, okay, what are you trying to build? So I explained to him and he said, do you have a deck? So I showed him the deck that I developed and said, the deck is very bad. So I told him, okay, would you help me to make it better? And he said, yes. So we spend an hour every month refining the deck. And then after a few months, he told me, Gil, it's no good. You're ready to raise money. So I told him, okay, are you willing to invest? And by the way, this person is a serial entrepreneur, PhD from MIT. He's a more mechanical engineer, but a very smart guy. And he said, yeah, I will invest. So that's how I started. I started to collect money from people that really believe in me or in the mission. It was very hard. And from here, I can continue the story if you want to.
I think this is something you caught something that is missing. And when you look at the world of entrepreneurs and C-level executive in biotech from the PhD student perspective, they see it as you mentioned, as like a black and white transition. One day you're that, the other day you're here. And you describing a process of learning, of mentorship that brought you to the place that you were good on your science, that was to start with. And at the end of this, you were good on your science and you can pitch it and sell it as a product at the end, which is like a huge, I personally go through this as well. It's a huge journey. And there are many skills and fine details that you need to perfect along the way. And it's very important for our audience to understand that it is a process. You have to do this. Most of the time you have to do this, as you described, while you're doing something else, while you're doing a postdoc, while you have a position in another entry level or another position in industry, learn and go along the way. So that is very important and very intriguing. So he was the CEO was the seed investor, your angel?
It was one of. I raised money from a few investors. It was a very little amount of money that allowed me basically to build what we done. We done some market research to prove to future investors that there is a merit of our model, that people really want it. And we also build a model of a design, model that how the product will look like. And then we ran out of money, and then I had to raise another round to develop the MVP of the product. And then we ran out of the money again, but I was lucky enough to meet with a very nice people that were related and had some connection with professional athletes. And I was fortunate enough to recruit some of them to be our customers. And that's made the new investor also excited about that. So we raised a bit of more money, and that's how we done it. It's
just the time frame. This is like this is 2009.
Basically, it was August 2009. I quit my job at the Next Generation Sequencing Company. And I raised the money, I think that it was early 2010, the first round. So basically a few months, I haven't had any income. And during that, after that, when I raised the money, I literally took a salary of a postdoc. So I continued to earn a salary of a postdoc for a few years, until we started to become bigger and more customers and more investors. So it's definitely a lot of toll on yourself and on your family. You're going a few steps back, but I'm not regretting it, let's say.
Sure. I have a question. I'm working on different projects, and a question that comes up often is, if you're a PhD and you have a sort of a technology you want to develop or start a company, a lot of the time the advice the scientist would get is find someone with an MBA or someone with business experience, and you can't do it without them. You need someone like that. So from your experience, would you give the same advice, or is...
Yeah, it's a good question. I haven't had a partner that is an MBA. But what I have done, I found a very good mentor. So for example, the CEO of the Next Generation Sequencing Company was my first mentor, okay? And mm-hmm. he's still, whenever I need, I'm asking him a question. A lot of time he's now asking me for help. It's, you know, someone help you, or you are helping him. Yeah. After that, I think a couple of years after I founded the company, when I was looking for money, and all the time you're looking for money, someone introduced me to a very successful serial entrepreneur, Israeli serial entrepreneur, that built a couple of companies from zero to become very big, and sold one to Nokia and one for IBM. And me and him, in a way, fall in love, and we are working together until this day. He's now the executive chairman of our board. And he became my mentor, and he helped me understand, helped me to raise money, helped me to, because you have a lot of data and you need to analyze all the time. And as someone that is in the weed, it's very hard to look at the forest. And he helped me to look at the forest and extract the good from the bad and so on. And then a couple of years after that, I hired the CEO. That is having a MBA and have a lot of experience. And actually we're working together till this day. He's the CEO of the company, and we have a very unique relationship. He's always telling me that he knows me better than my wife, better than my wife know me, and he might be right. So I think that you need to find people like that. So to answer the question, do you need someone with MBA from the beginning? It depends. Everyone is different, and every situation is different. I think that you need to, my best advice that I can give is try to find people that you can trust and try to ask advice as much as you can. And don't be afraid that someone will steal your idea, because it's very easy to come with an idea. It's very hard to take the idea to a product. I know I have a lot of friends with a lot of ideas that haven't done it, and to take the idea to a product, it's very hard, it's time consuming, it's most people will fail. So don't worry about it. If you are strong enough and determined enough, you will do it, and you will do it well. So don't worry about someone will steal your idea. I don't think that it's happening. And even now, when I'm now I'm building a sort of a new company in the company, and I'm talking with a lot of different companies, and I'm telling them about what I'm doing because I want to learn from them how can I do it better. And I know that's very hard, so most likely they won't do it. They won't compete with me.
It's very cool that you partnered with people outside of the field. So you said the entrepreneur that you worked with and acted as active chairman with your company came outside of your research field and augmented. So it's a feature. It for us is, again, it connects to the lone wolf syndrome from academia. We had to do everything from ideation to protocol design to write it up and then publish and then advocate for this later on in conferences. We did everything as an academic. And now it's the idea of that I need people to augment some skills that will be better not learning myself, but really being supported by others. It is hard. I'm in a similar position in building a small venture from zero right now and spinning out of academia and really understanding that there are things that I should not be doing. I should work with people who I feel comfortable with, and they are augmenting us together. So some will be in charge of computational, some will be in charge of wet lab, and some will build the business. And together you reach up to the end result. Those are leaps of it's not faith, but it's like leaps of personal development that needs to be done while you do the transition and end up building your own venture, which is very satisfying at the end when it works.
I agree with you. It's not easy, but it's very important to come and know this is my special power. Okay, everyone needs to know what is his special power. So from the get-go, I knew that I'm not my special power is not to be a CEO and be the business person. I'm helping them a lot, but that's not my special power. But I know today, after 12 years doing that, that my special power is more innovation and building products and doing science and be excited about the science. So I'm doing that. But let the other do their job. And especially when the company is growing, now we have around 100 people in the company. So more and more you are letting go more and more, and you are doing more like management or taking a specific domain and try to focus on that. But you can definitely not be involved in everything. You can't, and it doesn't make sense.
So when you started Insight Tracker and the idea was, and this is why I ask you about the timeline of like 2009, 2010, it's before the age of IoT and before cell phones were very, very well, well equipped. Did you think that this will be something that will coincide, like converge with your idea at the end to provide better optimization properties to your customers?
Yeah, of course, I thought about it, but it's very, very hard to predict the future. So I didn't know exactly what will happen, but I knew that the technology is going very fast. So I was sure that I think that the iPhone came in 2008, as much as I remember. So the iPhone was already around, but I'm not sure that there have been a lot of apps. Actually, our mobile app was released like 2 years ago, because when we built the Insight Tracker, we built it on the web. And then when apps started to come, I didn't want to build an app that is the same as all the other apps, because I knew that there is no merit for that. So I spent a lot of time of thinking with my team, of course, it's not me alone. We thought a lot about how can we make this app unique? And it took us a lot of time. And then a few years ago, we came with the idea of develop it. And it's, indeed, it's a very unique. Our user really like it, and we see a phenomenal growth right now. But again, my suggestion is don't push it. A month in the lab will save you an hour in the library, okay? So spend the hour in the library instead of spending a month in the lab, and then you will save the month in the lab. So I think that it's very important for all of us to think, and it's it's really true also for someone that stays in the academia. Think about what you are doing, be sure to read enough, know enough, and then do what you do. Because if you're not, you will waste a lot of your time.
So I wanted to touch upon a little bit about science abroad. So you founded it when you were still a postdoc, right? For a really long time, it was sort of geared towards academia. I started to volunteer with science abroad about 4 years ago. And I think back then when someone suggested that we should talk about industry, it was sort of a big no-no and everyone said it's not going to be interesting to anyone. But you were doing it yourself, right? You were supporting this organization. You're very involved in it. And still it was for a really long time, it was geared towards academia. It was supporting scientists to get an academic position, bridging the gap to PIs and really making this sort of very supportive environment for postdocs. And as you said, it's a sort of many of the scientists are quite lonely and provided this sort of supporting group for this time abroad. Why do you think it was sort of so distant from industry for such a long time?
I don't think that it was distance. I think that it's similar to being a PI in the academia. It's you need to run after the money, and the money that we got was the money from the Ministry of Absorption in Israel, and they supported us in the direction of more that direction. Also, our audience, basically the postdocs, show a lot of resistance to become to move to the industry. And we tried very hard, but it wasn't successful. So we had to go with the stream. But I want to tell you that in the last, let's say, few years, we are pushing more and more to the industry, and we are trying to do as much as we can. Because the reality is that we can help the people that want to go to the academia. We can give them grants. We can have some webinar with a professor in the academia and so on. But most of it is already established. The road is paved, you know exactly what to do. It's what I learned 10 years ago, most likely are the same what you learn today. I think that with the industry, there is a lot of unknown for someone that do a postdoc. It's much more, it's less paved, it's much more confusing. And I think that also there is much more room. So I don't know, let's say that there are 50 positions in the academia per year per, let's say, biology scientist in Israel. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds or maybe thousands positions for someone in the academia, so in the industry. And so I think that also the opportunity is much bigger. And that's why we really believe in that. And we believe in that from the get-go. And we, I mean, it's Shmulik, which is the co-founder of the Science Abroad, and Dan Ginzel, that is, let's say, from the early days. Also, all of us really believe in that and want to push that. But you cannot always go directly to your North Star. That's our North Star. But sometimes you need to go a bit left or a bit right in order to get to that. And in order to do that, we had to get funding. You know, right now, I think that the organization is doing very well, so we can start doing that. And but it was the vision from day one.
Yeah, that's always, it was interesting to me because all the founders, all three of you are not really in academia.
Yeah.
So do you think the winds are changing? Are postdocs are more sort of aware what the industry has to offer?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so. I think that I think that the mindset is that being a professor in the academia is the North Star, and everything else that you will do is a failure. I think that that's a very bad view. Yeah. And there are so many other things to do. By the way, part of what I done at MIT is one of my fellow postdoc at Lenny's lab said, hey, BCG BCG is looking for a consultant and they are looking for some PhD. So we went and got tested for that. And then we decided not to go, but it was nice to test it, understand what is going on. During my postdoc, I also try to use or to learn a couple of courses at the Sloan Business School at MIT, because I've been there, so why not? So I spent some time there. So there are a lot of resources that you can use at the university to learn. You can, I know that Dan Ginsel spent some time at the technology transfer office at Easy University. There are a lot of things that you can do during your postdoc to start to be exposed to the other opportunities. And I think that a lot of them are, let's say they are not less desired than being a professor in the academia. There are a lot of problems today to find a grant and to build a lab and to recruit people and to publish paper. And it's very hard. The life of the academician are not easy. And I'm not sure that they are more exciting than my life. I think that they are not, but I don't want to argue with anyone.
We have a recurring question, which is, what is the biggest myth you had about science and industry, which you know now that is not true? I think you mentioned really a lot of those, being sort of smart, being people being only in academia, being having more exciting careers in academia, and a lot about the funding and so on. Is there something else that you've sort of came to realization about during your career?
Yeah, I think that as a postdoc, I was a bit arrogant, and I felt like, hey, I will decide to go to the industry, and then a 50 company will run after me, and they will bring their chopper with the red carpet and they take me to my office at the company, and I realized that it's really not like that, and it's not easy to get a job in the industry. So anyone that wants to move, I would say that finding a job is a job. So spend at least a secure 6 to 12 months to look for a job, and be sure to learn and have a few options and know what is good for you. Is it a wet lab? Is it a dry lab? Do you want to do more animal work or cell culture, whatever? I think that that's a big miss that I had. I'm not sure that other people have it right now, but I know that at that time, a lot of other people believe in that.
Interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I see a lot of, I'm still currently in a postdoc position. So I see a lot of grad students and postdoc coming in, and then the grad students, mostly American grad students, they preparing, as you mentioned. They are taking the last year of their grad school in preparation for the next steps. And they have a career path in mind. And a lot of the postdocs are, okay, so I'm done. What now? I don't know what to do. And it's a lot of preparation and everything. And it's also something we try to advocate and raise here a lot, is that it's okay to have this plan A, North Star of being a professor in academia. That's fine. That's good for most, like a lot of people, and this is what they need. But you always have to have a plan B and work and build it. Don't just have it in your back drawer. Just actually work on it. As you mentioned, and Lena mentioned, working, there are a lot of opportunities in tech transfer and taking the test, as you mentioned, for BCG, for one of the consulting companies. That opens up and that builds those skills. You know how to talk the language, you get interviewed better and all of those. It's a job to find a job, exactly.
As some of us painfully know. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Gil, thank you so much for your time. I know we have to wrap up. It's been really, really interesting to learn about the process. I think there are a lot of lessons to be learned here. Be prepared, think about the future. And also that the science that you do in your company can sort of diverge from what you were sort of trained on. As long as the science is solid and you learn along the way, that's it's great and it's amazing. And I think there are so many opportunities that people are sort of leaving on the table, and they, you know, once they realize that it's a possibility, they can hang on to. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Gil. And I love the mission of Insight Tracker, of adding years to our lives and lives to our years. I think that resonates very, very clearly with me and hopefully with all the audience. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Lena and Ofer. It was my pleasure.